Shalom, Hadavar Nix. Welcome to our next session of the First Regathering Modern Israel. This will be session 43. You'll find it on page 384 of your workbook, of your notebook, session 43. Okay, let's do a little bit of review to bring us up to speed to where session 43 picks up. All right, last time we saw that terrorism was still a constant threat in Israel. And one of the more horrific and terrible terrorist attacks was the attack at Itamar on the Fogel family. Two terrorists entered the settlement of Itamar and killed mom and dad and three children. And the three children were killed in their beds. It was a horrific attack, and it really shows you the depth to which the terrorists have sunk. Takes a lot of courage to kill three little boys and a baby, two little boys and a baby in their beds. Such a terrorist. Good news, Gilad Shalit was released and the nation rejoiced. The Hamas rocket attack continued to expand. The Hamas had now added the Fayyar 5 missile to their arsenal with a range of 75 kilometers. This put Herzliya within range of the rockets, and Dimona. Originally, they had been out of range, so the rocket threat continues. This constant rocket threat and bombardment prompted the IDF to assassinate Ahmed Yabari, the second in command of the military wing of Hamas, a man responsible for hundreds of Israeli deaths and ongoing terrorist attacks. That also led to Operation Pillar Defense in order to try to minimize Hamas's ability to fire and to bring terrorism out of the Gaza Strip. And Pillar Defense, the IDF attacked 1,500 terror sites, which should tell you that Hamas has made the Gaza Strip into an armed camp. It's not a country. It's not a city. It's an armed camp. On the good side, offshore natural gas began to flow from the Tamar offshore natural gas field in the Mediterranean, giving Israel a big step forward in energy independence. So Israel rejoiced at that event too. Here's one of those offshore oil rigs, natural gas rigs that are drilling and processing that natural gas. Great big economic boon for Israel. The Reverend Dr. Kenneth Mishu came to Israel. He'd been here before, but he made some very strong statements supporting Israel and telling the world that Israel is not an apartheid state. He lived under apartheid. He knows what apartheid is. He knows that does not exist in Israel, just a deliberate distortion of the facts in order to try and denigrate the nation. Hamas terror tunnels were discovered and eliminated. Here we see some of the one of the tunnels, very sophisticated tunnels, concrete lined, also very, very effective weapon. We closed last time talking about the Iran nuclear capability negotiations as a number of nations met with Iran to try and talk them into eliminating their nuclear program and moving away from the capability to have nuclear weapons. There was the negotiating table. Here are the delegates, the British Foreign Minister from left to right, British Foreign Secretary William Hague, German Minister of Foreign Affairs Guido Westerwelle, EU High Commissioner Catherine Ashton, Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs Sergei Lavrov, and French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabi. So all these people are involved trying to convince Iran that they should give up their nuclear program. And of course, Iran is constantly speaking about destroying Israel, constantly saying that Israel must go. And so this is a great concern to Israel, this nuclear program. All right, this brings us to page 384, middle of the page, and July 8th, 2014, Operation Protective Edge. And this article, I'm going to read some quotes from this article, comes from the Jewish Virtual Library. The author starts with the background of Protective Edge. What provoked the recent escalation in violence, is the question. He writes, since Israel evacuated every settler and soldier from the Gaza Strip 7 years ago in hopes of stimulating the peace process, it has been attacked by Hamas. And I just want to note that acts favorable to the Palestinians have only stimulated more terrorism. That's because of the Arab mentality. The Arab mentality is that might makes right. If you're strong, you take what you want. You don't give up anything. You don't negotiate. So when Israel gives up some land here, pulls out of the Gaza Strip, the perception of the Arabs is that, they're scared of us. They're weak. We're going to win. So we press on ever harder to get what we want. I wish the Western world would understand this Arab mindset of power and strength and honor, by the way. So acts favorable to the Palestinians have only stimulated more terrorism. Thousands of deadly rockets and mortars were fired into southern Israel, causing deaths, injuries, and creating a constant fear and anxiety among nearly 1 million Israelis living within rocket range. The barrage finally created such a threat that the security of Israel against Israel's citizens that Israel launched Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to degrade Hamas's ability to engage in terror. That was somewhat successful, next sentence, for 5 years. Terrorist attacks continued sporadically, before increasing dramatically in 2012. So it was partially successful. More than 1,300 rockets were fired into Israel, provoking the killing of Hamas military commander Ahmed Jawari, November 14th, and eventually Operation Pillar of Defense. We've talked about that. In the summer of 2014, violence between Israelis and Palestinians escalated with the kidnapping and murder of 3 Israeli and 1 Palestinian teenagers. And here is a screenshot of the Fox News alert stating that the bodies of the 3 teens missing in Israel were found in Hebron. These 3 young men were abducted and immediately killed. Gilad Shaar, Naftali Frankel, and Yael Yifrach. And these 3 young men were laid side by side in the graveyard. I believe this is in Moedim. But these 3 young men laid together. Now you see the rocks on the headstones. That's not a lack of care for the graves. It is Jewish tradition that if you visit a grave, you leave a reminder that will last longer than, you know, just some flowers that decay away. So it's become the Jewish tradition to put a rock on the headstone as a long-term reminder, long-term evidence that someone cared, someone was here. And so you see these stones placed upon the headstones of these 3 Israelis. Well, unfortunately, some other Israelis took the law into their own hands, and Mohammed Abu Qadir, young teenage boy, was murdered as well. And of course, this raised tensions to a very high peak as well. Hamas greatly increased rocket fire, including a reported 131 launches between July 7th and July 8th. Even on July 7th, Israel was seeking a ceasefire and a de-escalation. That was confirmed by the Arabic daily Al-Hayat. But in spite of Israel trying to calm the waters, this led to a third Gaza operation in 5 years. Israel was forced to begin Operation Protective Edge. So that's the background. Now, what are Israel's objectives for Operation Protective Edge? Like other nations, Israel maintains its right to self-defense against threats to its civilian population. According to IDF spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, the IDF's goal is to stop the terror Israel's citizens face on a daily basis. Now we're moving to page 385. Go to page 385. Israel also seeks to prevent tunnels from being built underground into Israel, and they want to hinder Hamas's ability to make violence against Israel's civilian population. So thousands of reserve troops have been mobilized, but Israelis do not want to initiate a ground operation in Gaza, They've done everything possible to avoid one. The magnitude of the danger to millions of Israelis, however, may leave Israel with no other choice. Israel has said that the operation will end when Hamas stops its rocket fire. And remember, this rocket fire, this constant harassment, has been going on since before 2008. And Israel has said consistently, we will leave you alone. All you have to do is leave us alone. And you know, the Israeli friends I've talked to have said the same thing. I haven't met an Israeli that hates the Arabs or hates the Palestinians. All my Israeli friends have said the same thing. If they don't like us, why don't they just leave us alone? And we will leave them alone. That's all the average Israeli would like. All right, now on page 385, we come to an article called Operation Protective Edge, written by Ben Hartman, appeared in the Jerusalem Post. So let me read some excerpts from this article as well. 50 days of Israel's Gaza operation, Protective Edge by the numbers. For 50 days of war, the home front and soldiers on the front lines were battered by thousands of rockets and mortar shells as armed groups in Gaza fired, now get this, 4,564 projectiles at Israel. If that is not a call to war, I don't know what is. Shooting 4,564 projectiles of any sort, rockets, mortars, into Israel, that is a call to war. Well, the a map of Operation Protective Edge showed that Hamas had increased its rocket threat even more. Now, in addition to the M75, we find the M302 with a range not of 75 kilometers, but now 160 kilometers. So that brings Haifa within range of the rockets. So as you see on the map here, only the Galilee from the Jezreel Valley north and the far southern end of the Negev is out of rocket range. So the vast majority of Israel's population sits underneath this threat. Now this statistic, 4,564 rockets fired at Israel, was one of several released by the IDF as the fighting ended Tuesday night. According to the Army, 3,659 rocket and mortar impact sites were found, counting those fired on IDF soldiers in Gaza. Of those that struck in Israel, 224 hit built-up areas. A further 735 were shot down by the Iron Dome missile defense system, and this is where Iron Dome came into its own. And the Israelis were very, very pleased with the operation of this anti-missile system. Here is a setup of a couple of the Iron Dome systems have been deployed. They were deployed around the country in various areas. This is a photograph of one of the Iron Dome missiles heading on its way to intercept an incoming missile. And that's an amazing, amazing feat and task that you can, you so design the program that, or the missile, and the radar, that it can intercept an incoming missile at high altitude. And there's a photograph of an Iron Dome interception, an amazing feat. And it was carried out with regularity during Operation Protective Edge. Also, the IDF said that there were 197 failed launchings, projectiles that never left Gaza or did not launch at all. During the war, 70 people were killed on the Israeli side, including 64 soldiers. Gaza health officials said that more than 2,100 people were killed in the Strip during the fighting, and many thousands more were wounded. Now, the next couple of comments are market up moments, something I want you to note. The Office of the Coordinator of Government Activities in the Territories, the body responsible for running the Israeli border crossings with Gaza, said that since the operation began in July 8th, 959 tons of medicine and medical supplies have entered the Strip through the crossings, and that 5,359 trucks carrying goods entered through the Kerem Shalom crossing. But note, the crossing and Kibbutz Kerem Shalom were targeted by mortars and rockets throughout the war. So notice, Israel is trying its best to get humanitarian aid in to the civilians in the Gaza Strip, 959 tons of medicine and medical supplies, and still Hamas rockets and mortars, the very crossing points through which this humanitarian aid is flowing. Next sentence. A total of 82,201 IDF reservists were called up during the war. 82,201 reservists. And you know, you folks know one of these reservists. Do you happen to remember who he was? Well, it was Yinon. Here's a picture of Yinon. Remember, he had come to the United States and was doing research in Southern California. And we at Hadavar were able to give him some housing for a number of days. And we invited him to speak to the morning and evening First Regathering classes. And he came in and he'd speak to you. And a number of you had very extensive and enjoyable private conversations with him. And so this is a picture he sent to me after he returned to Israel. This is a picture of Yinon with his wife, his daughter, and his two sons. So the reason I put this picture up, the reason I do this is to impress upon you that the wars that happen in Israel are not some impersonal, distant tragedy that happens over there that doesn't affect me. You happen to know one of these 82,201 reservists that were called up. In fact, if Yinon had not been called up, it would have been only 82,200 reservists. You know, he's the one. He was called up. He was taken away, just like the other 82,200, from his children, from his wife, to go face the dangers of the battlefield. So this is not some distant, impersonal thing. You know one of the soldiers that was called up. So I would hope that would cause you to pray for Yinon and pray for the Israelis when they come under attack and have to go on the defensive or sometimes on the offensive against the enemies surrounding them. They'll be praying for Yinon. Now, throughout the fighting, 64 soldiers were killed and 469 were wounded. During the operation, the IDF struck some 5,226 targets in Gaza. Note that, 5,226, including 1,814 targets linked to rocket firing, 109 weapons depots, and 85 weapons-making facilities. In addition, the army also attacked 312 houses belonging to people who were involved with terrorism, according to the IDF. So again, I repeat, Gaza is not a country. Gaza is an armed camp. Gaza is a military camp. Page 386. The Air Force also carried out 840 strikes in support of ground forces and 192 attacks on Hamas military and training sites. The destruction of Hamas attack tunnels was a central goal of the operation, and the IDF said that 32, every one that it identified, were eliminated. And again, here's some information on those tunnels. Here is a map of six of those 32 terror attack tunnels that were destroyed. And on the map, you can see the dotted lines. The dotted lines are the tunnels themselves and how far they had entered into Israel. They were trying to reach Kfar Aza, Sa'ad, and Nahal Oz. Nahal Oz, I guess, would be a better way to pronounce that. And some of the shafts had actually reached their locations. Some were very, very close. And again, these are not just simple military expedients. These are tunnels that are very, very, very carefully planned and constructed. Here you can see an IDF soldier standing in the tunnel. And again, you see the concrete supports. And of course, he's standing at the end of the tunnel. They have not yet put all the concrete supports in place, but you can see that there's tracks and electrical wiring, fairly sophisticated tunnels. And remember, these tunnels are quite deep. Here's the end of one that's about 30 or 40 feet underground. So these are very sophisticated strategy of Hamas to build these tunnels. Now, according to Magen David Adom, that is the equivalent of the Red Cross. That's the Israeli Red Cross. That's a good way to put it. According to Magen David Adom, there were 842 Israeli casualties during the fighting. Six civilians were killed by rocket or mortar strikes, 36 wounded by shrapnel, including 10 who were seriously injured, 6 moderately injured, and 20 who sustained light injuries. Magen David Adom added that another 33 people were hurt by flying glass. 18 people were hurt in traffic accidents that occurred when rocket warning sirens sounded, including one person who was seriously injured. Also, 195 people were injured while running for bomb shelters. You don't think of that, do you? You head off for the bomb shelter and trip over the curb and break your leg. 159 people were injured while running for bomb shelters, 581 treated for shock. In addition, 9 people were killed in 3 terrorist attacks that went on in Israel. Well, at this point, you should have received a couple of handouts. One is a buff one written by Charles Krauthammer called Moral Clarity in Gaza. Put this behind page 385. I thought it was a great article. I thought it was well worth reproducing for you. And also, you've received this chart called War and Peace. And it charts out the periods of war and the periods of peace experienced by Israel since its beginning in 1948 all the way up to Operation Protective Edge in 2014. So both of these handouts should go behind page 385 in your notebook. Now I'd like to close Operation Protective Edge with 3 slides. I'd like to point out, as Stand With Us put this slide together, Israel has agreed to a ceasefire during Protective Edge 4 times. But what has been Hamas's response? Each time, Hamas has refused. July 15th, Israel suspended strikes in Gaza for 6 hours. Hamas continued firing rockets. July 17th, Israel suspended strikes for UN humanitarian aid. Hamas continued firing rockets. July 20th, Israel agreed to a Red Cross request ceasefire in Shuyaya. And I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, the name of that little city. Hamas continued firing rockets at Israel from where? From Shuyaya. And finally, July 26, Israel suspended strikes for humanitarian aid. Hamas continued firing rockets. So Hamas just takes advantage of Israel's attempts to care for the civilian population in the Gaza Strip during a time of war. Hamas does not care about the civilian population. In fact, if there are civilian casualties, so much the better. It makes great media fodder. All right, my next slide. Israel has been accused of desiring genocide, killing all the Palestinians. But Jonah Goldberg in the LA Times on July 14th made this comment. He said, if the Israelis wanted to wipe out as many Palestinians as possible, never mind commit genocide, they probably wouldn't issue warnings to Gazans by phone and leaflet to get out of harm's way. And it's well known that Israel will do all it can. They'll make phone calls. They'll drop leaflets saying, we are going to hit this target. Get out of town. Get away from it. They will warn the civilian population. Israel does not want civilian casualties. They want to minimize the collateral damage from warfare. It's not exactly true of Hamas. For example, this is a slide put out by the Israeli Defense Forces, and this is the best quote to come out of Operation Defensive Shield. Israel uses weapons to protect its civilians. And there you see the civilians in a bomb shelter, Operation Protective, or Iron Dome missile battery, and a jet flying overhead. So Israel uses weapons to protect its civilians, but go to the right side of the slide. Hamas uses civilians to protect its weapons. This is because weapons were found underneath UN schools and underneath synagogues and houses. So Hamas uses civilians to protect its weapons. Hamas calls the civilians to get on the roofs of any target, and they know the IDF will not hit that target if civilians are on the roof. So Hamas deliberately puts Palestinian civilians in the line of fire. The two nations are very, very different. The two armies, I should say, are very, very different. Hamas puts Palestinian civilians in the line of fire. Israel protects Israeli civilians. All right, let's take a look at December 31st, 2014. We'll close out 2014 with this article on immigration. Israel hails its highest immigration figures in a decade. December 31st, 2014, Jerusalem. The number of Jews moving to Israel leapt in 2014 to its highest figure in a decade, with Western Europe leading the way, the immigration ministry said on Wednesday. Immigration hit a 10-year high with the arrival of 26,500 new residents, according to a joint statement with the Jewish Agency, a quasi-governmental organization tasked with encouraging Jews to move to Israel. This marks a significant 32% increase over last year's approximately 20,000 immigrants, the statement said. It was a year of record-breaking aliyah, Jewish Agency Chairman Natan Sharansky said, using the Hebrew word for immigration to Israel. That's aliyah, the word aliyah, to go up to Jerusalem. Now, notice the next sentence, the next quote. It, quote, also saw an historic shift. For the first time in Israel's history, the number of immigrants who came to Israel from the free world is greater than the number of immigrants fleeing countries in distress. Big change there. For the first time ever, France provided the biggest number of immigrants. More than 6,000 moved to Israel, nearly twice the 3,400 that arrived in 2013. And you know why that is? That's because France is the most anti-Semitic country in Europe these days, and that's due to its the fact that it has the largest Muslim population in Europe these days. Overall, immigration from Western Europe increased 88%, with the arrival of some 8,640 people compared to 4,600 in the previous year. All right, page 387. Page 387. Some 620 arrived from Britain, compared with 520 a year earlier, and the number from Italy doubled to 340. Around 240 arrived from Belgium, a slight decrease, and the number from Germany remained stable at approximately 120. Immigration from the former Soviet Union countries saw a 50% increase, with the arrival of some 11,430 people, compared to 7,610 in 2013. And that immigration from the former Soviet Union countries was largely driven by an exodus from conflict-riven Ukraine. The Ukraine has been in turmoil. The number surged 190% to 5,840. More than half of all people moving to Israel in 2014 were under 35, among them 5,300 children and some 8,200 adults between the ages of 18 and 34. Tel Aviv was the city which received the highest number of immigrants, around 3,000. It was followed by the northern coastal city of Netanya, and that's a beautiful city, you guys. I think if I made Aliyah, I think I would consider Netanya as well. Beautiful seacoast city. Followed by Netanya and then Jerusalem. Jerusalem was number 3 on the list. So Zionism is not dead. Zionism is not dead yet. Many Jewish people are still making aliyah to Zion. Now, let me conclude this section I call Israel Present by sharing some odds and ends from 2014. Now, these are odds and ends that I either overlooked or I feel worthwhile adding to the material. So I see that you're just about to your break. So why don't we take the odds and ends after your break? And we'll start with the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge. So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar, and we'll pick it up with odds and ends. All right, Hadavarnik, we're back, and we're picking up just the concluding portion of Israel Present, the first regathering, Israel Present, and we're going to start with the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge. Israel, an article in israeltoday.co.il, and I'd like to read this entire article. It's headlined, "The Mega Attack, Israel's Gaza War Prevented." Israel may or may not achieve all of its military objectives via Hamas by the time a ceasefire is imposed in Gaza. But it would appear the current war effort accomplished something far more important in thwarting a planned mega attack. Listen to this, you guys. About a week ago, Israeli troops operating in Gaza confiscated Hamas documents and computers that contained details of a planned major assault against southern Israel. As the ground war got underway a couple of weeks ago, Israel was surprised by the number and the complexity of the terror tunnels Hamas had dug under the Gaza border and into sovereign Israeli territory. What it only learned later, after capturing the aforementioned intelligence, was that all these tunnels, 32 of them, I believe, all these tunnels were part of one elaborate attack scheme. As per Hamas documents, on Rosh Hashanah this year, that would be September 24th, 2014, up to 200 Hamas gunmen were to pour out of each of the dozens upon dozens of terror tunnels, many of which we now know exit inside or very near Israeli civilian communities. While the Hamas plan is in scope grand beyond achievability, there is no doubt that an attack of that scale would have resulted in many Israeli casualties and possibly a number of abductions. In fact, many of the tunnels uncovered over the past week were found to contain holding rooms where presumably Hamas intended to hide kidnapped Israelis. A number of Hamas fighters captured by Israel in recent days have confirmed that the plan was real. And they said that they had been promised by their leadership that the mass coordinated assault would begin the ultimate demise of the Zionist enemy. Israel's war in Gaza, and in particular the focus on destroying the terror tunnels, severely disrupted Hamas's plans. Which the prisoners said had required some 12 years in preparation. See, these sophisticated tunnels had taken 12 years to build. This was a very, very major part of their strategy to attack Israel. Well, as we go on, here's a Jerusalem Post article by Yaakov Lapin on February 4th, 2015. The aftermath of Operation Protective Edge, Hamas is fast rebuilding guerrilla terrorist forces in Gaza. Hamas and its allied terrorist organizations in Gaza have spent recent months intensively rebuilding their guerrilla terrorist capabilities, which sustained significant damage during Operation Protective Edge last summer. And the history repeats itself. Israel degrades their military capability. They come right back, rebuilding it again. So any kind of ground attack is only partially successful and only lasts for a few years. Their aim is to recover the military infrastructure that was damaged and return it to full capabilities and broaden it, according to a recent report by the Meir Amit Intelligence and Terrorist Information Center in Tel Aviv. This is part of the Israeli Intelligence Heritage and Commemoration Center, founded by leading members of the Israeli intelligence community. To that end, Hamas has allocated the necessary funds, the necessary personnel, the necessary equipment, despite the shortages suffered by the civilian sector in the Strip, the study found. This stands out especially against the background of the ongoing delay in the civilian recovery in the Gaza Strip. See, Gaza received a lot of damage, and the rebuilding is taking a lot of time. Adding that, this illustrates well that, as in the past, Hamas's priorities clearly lie in rebuilding military capabilities at the expense of civilian needs. Dr. Reuven Ehrlich, head of the Terrorism and Intelligence Center, told the Jerusalem Post, "We see that when it comes to military programs, resources flow without a problem. When it comes to civilian rebuilding, there's a problem. But when it comes to military resources, no problema, yet problema." Hamas in Gaza is using mass media to safeguard and strengthen support among the Gazan public for its military wing and to propagate the idea of armed resistance while indoctrinating children and teenagers, the report's author said. The program is aimed at both replenishing the military wing's ranks and support for Hamas among the Gazan population, which is suffering extreme hardship in the aftermath of the summer conflict with Israel. Hamas has begun to reconstruct its network of tunnels within Gaza, and Israel is watching out for any signs of cross-border attack tunnels as well, Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon said in December. And notice the last sentence I'm going to read you. Hamas's domestic rocket production is rapidly replenishing the Islamist regime's arsenal of projectiles. Again, it never stops. Gaza is an armed camp. They lose men, they lose materiel, and they simply replace them. All right, let's take a look at January 11th. We'll jump back to January and January 11th, 2014. And this date was the date of the death of Ariel Sharon. He had suffered a major stroke on January 4th, 2006. And then after 8 years in a coma, he died on January 11th. So this is the Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, 1928 to 2014. A giant of a man in the modern state of Israel's history. One of those giants that were produced by in the first generation of the nation of Israel. So because he was so important in Israel's history, let me give you a short photo montage of his life. Here is a picture of Ariel Sharon, age 14. There's our young Ariel Sharon, young 14-year-old, growing up on the kibbutz. Years later, this is Major Ariel Sharon in 1955. Here he is moving up the ranks of the Israel Defense Forces, and he's standing there, of course, next to Moshe Dayan. So Major Ariel Sharon. Years later, 1973, we now come to Major General Ariel Sharon. This is during the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Again, he's pictured here with Moshe Dayan. And this is a photograph of his funeral. He was buried with honor in Israel. Many nations sent representatives. You can see the United States Vice President Joe Biden speaking in the background. So Israel mourned the passing of Ariel Sharon, and the Palestinians, well, they rejoiced. They hated Ariel Sharon, and they blamed him for many of their troubles. And this cartoon shows Ariel Sharon marching into hell with his sins chained to his ankle. Of course, this is, again, the Palestinian view of Ariel Sharon. They hated him. All righty. Here's an article from September 28th, IsraelNationalNews.com, Arut Sheva, in regard to the Third Temple. Remember, the Third Temple is a very, very biblically important event that it will be coming to pass fairly soon. This article states, Temple Institute raises $100,000 for the Third Temple plans. The Temple Institute's crowdfunding campaign to raise funds for the modern architectural plans for the Third Holy Temple in Jerusalem came to a close on Rosh Hashanah after surpassing its $100,000 goal in 60 days. The funds raised will be used to continue the research of the Institute and to commission additional architectural plans. The architects will fuse Jewish law with modern technology to prepare a fully modern Third Temple, kosher to the letter of the law. But, now listen to this, you guys, I think this is great, but including modern conveniences like underground parking. That wasn't needed in the first century, was it? Underground parking, heating, and computerized washing stations that minimize water waste. So it's going to be a modern temple. Here's a picture of the Third Temple superimposed on the Temple Mount. This is the goal of the Temple Institute and related similar organizations in Israel. the rebuilding of the Third Temple. We know the Third Temple has to be up and operating by the middle of the tribulation period. We may see it come into existence in our lifetime. But we know it'll be up by the middle of the tribulation. All right, my next odds and end from unitedwithisrael.org on September 29th, 2014. Headline, Israel is the only safe place for Christians in the Middle East. Nazareth priest tells the UN. Father Gabriel Nadaf, a Greek Orthodox priest from Nazareth and a loyal citizen of the State of Israel, told the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland on Tuesday that Israel is the only safe, only place in the Middle East where Christian minorities are safe. And here is a photograph of Father Gabriel Nadaf, again, a loyal citizen who appreciates the fact that he experiences freedom of worship in Israel. And Christians do not in Arab countries. His quote continues, in the Middle East today, there is one country where Christianity is only not persecuted, but affectionately granted freedom of expression, freedom of worship, and security, Nadaf declared. It is Israel, the Jewish state. Israel is the only place where Christians in the Middle East are safe. Well, did you notice that he said that Christianity is not persecuted? Well, he's talking there about Christian sects that don't evangelize. If you don't evangelize in Israel, you won't be persecuted. They don't care. You leave us alone. You Gentiles can have your religion. You leave us alone. We'll leave you alone. That's the Israeli attitude. But the Israelis that are on fire for evangelism and on fire for the salvation of their Israeli brothers and sisters are persecuted. We've seen that. We've seen that as well. They are granted freedom of expression, freedom of worship and security in the governmental level. But the Orthodox will attack and harass Christians. And not only those that are evangelizing, but they will be at the forefront of the harassment, but some of the people like the Greek Orthodox, sometimes they experience some harassment as well. But all in all, Father Nadaf is quite accurate. Israel is the only place where Christians in the Middle East are safe. Basically, Christians are safe in Israel, and that is not the case in all the other nations of the Middle East. All right, December 30th, 2014, from israeltoday.co.il, an article entitled, America, Israel is among the top most unacceptable countries, by David Lazarus. Here's some excerpts. The U.S. State Department in 2014 condemned Israel as one of the most unacceptable countries in the world, just behind, get this, North Korea. According to an article published last week by Foreign Policy, over the past year, the Obama administration, and remember I mentioned to you that President Obama is the most anti-Israel president of recent times. Over the past year, the Obama administration State Department cited Israel for unacceptable behavior more times than Pakistan, Russia, Egypt, China, Afghanistan, and Iraq. The article examined how many times a country's actions were condemned as unacceptable. Israel came in fourth, right after Syria, Iran, and North Korea. Most of the State Department's criticisms came in response to, guess what, to Israel announcements for its plan to build housing in Jerusalem. Israelis building homes is unacceptable. Syrians killing their civilians is fine. Hamas rockets are okay. But Israel building homes is unacceptable. David Lazarus asked the questions. How can building homes in Jerusalem be condemned on par with actions of nations repeatedly engaged in aggressive and murderous violence towards their own civilian populations with absolutely no regard for human rights? There's the question. There's the contrast. Israel's Ynet news portal found that the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon used the word concerned 140 times in 2014 in statements about world events, and Israel was the most concerning country of all. What is going on here, you guys? Well, what's going on is Zechariah 12:3. This section of scripture, this prophetic statement, is coming to pass step by step, gradually, a little bit at a time, right before our eyes. Zechariah 12:3. It will come about in that day, and he's speaking about the tribulation period. It will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. So Jerusalem is becoming a burdensome stone, even today, to all the nations of the world, including the U.S. Our current government considers Israel a real pain in the neck. All who lift it will be severely injured. A warning to the nations that come against Israel. And all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. And so this is slowly coming to pass. It will reach its apex during the middle of the tribulation. All the nations of the earth gathering against Israel with the campaign of Armageddon by the Antichrist. All right, so that wraps up my current version of the class, The First Regathering Modern Israel. Let's do a real quick review in the last few minutes that we have. At the beginning of this class, we looked at Israel past. That was the modern Zionist movement from 1839 to 1948. And the theme of that time period is the shrinking Jewish state. Remember this map? This map is the area allocated for a Jewish national home by the San Remo conference in 1920, right after World War I. And you notice that both sides of the Jordan River are given to the nation of Israel, what we call Israel today and Jordan today. That was all allocated for the Jewish national home. That was all considered Palestine. But it didn't last long. In 1921 to 1923, Great Britain divided the mandated area. Transjordan became everything to the east of the Jordan River. And now Palestine was suddenly everything to the west of the Jordan River. Transjordan was given to the Hashemite King Abdullah, and Palestine was still going to be the national home for the Jewish people, everything west of the Jordan River. Well, that didn't last long. The Peel Partition Plan of 1937 stated that only the coastline and the Galilee should be the Jewish national home. So now the Jewish national home is reduced even further. And then with the Woodhead Commission partition plan of 1939, the Woodhead Commission said, nah, let's take away Galilee from the Jews and their national home will be the seacoast only. So again, our theme, the shrinking Jewish state. Satan is trying to shrink the Jewish state out of existence using political means. It did not succeed. Then we examined Israel present from the formation of the modern state in 1948 until where we are here now today in 2014. And now the theme has reversed. The theme now is the shrinking Palestinian state. And here is the Palestinian claim to the land in 1947. They said, see all the green area? They said, all that green area, that's us, that's Palestine, that's our territory. The Jews, they've only purchased small little tracts of land. So all of Palestine is ours. Everything west of the Jordan is ours. Well, the UN didn't agree. That's amazing. The UN would support the Zionists. And the UN said, no, that's not quite true. And so they drew up the UN partition plan, in which the Palestinians were given the Gaza Strip and a section along the Egyptian border there in the Negev, the Judean Hills, and half of the Galilee. Israel got most of the Negev, the seacoast, and the other half of the Galilee. Well, Israel, the Zionists, were not happy with this, with their land being further divided, even smaller than it was originally, but they accepted it. They said, okay, we'll take a Jewish state on that boundaries. But the Arabs refused to accept those boundaries and attacked the new state of Israel when the British pulled out. But that attack backfired. Israel won the War of Independence. And from 1947 to the present, or I should say to 1967, this was the nation of Israel. The Gaza Strip was retained by the Palestinians and the portion of the West Bank pertained by the Palestinians. But then from 1967, with the Six-Day War, Israel conquered Gaza for a short time, and the West Bank and the Golan Heights, and then eventually gave back the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians. But the West Bank has continued to disintegrate, So you see, the Palestinian claim to the land has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. And now the West Bank is on the verge of disappearing. So what do we see now? We're seeing the shrinking Palestinian state. What is going on here? Well, what we have going on here is an example of Genesis 12:3. In Genesis 12:3, God says, "I will bless those who bless you," speaking of Abraham and his descendants, "and the one who curses you, I will curse." That's the Abrahamic covenant, an eternal, an unconditional covenant God made with the Jewish people through Abraham. And so the Palestinians, the Arabs, have tried to curse Israel by shrinking her out of existence using, first of all, political means and then military means. But God said, "You try to shrink my nation out of existence, I will shrink you out of existence. You curse my people, I will curse you." Curse for curse in kind. Curse for curse in kind. You tried to shrink my nation out of existence, I will shrink your nation out of existence. All right. So the question is, where do we go from here? To answer that question, I'd like to continue our class by dealing with a related and relevant but separate subject. What I'd like to explore is what the Bible has to say about Israel's future. So that's the upcoming class, Israel future. Now, by Israel future, I mean the near future. What does the Bible tell us about Israel prior to the tribulation period? I'm not talking about the far future. I'm not talking about the tribulation period, the Messianic kingdom, or the eternal state. You see, a study of those topics belongs to eschatology. A study of the tribulation, for example, well, a study of all those topics is found in the book of Revelation, which has been covered already by Pastor Dennis Sherman. It's available on the heart of our website. The book of Revelation is dedicated to explaining the tribulation and giving you a glimpse at the Messianic kingdom and then an even shorter glimpse of the eternal state. And that's a very, very extensive and involved class. So I don't want to go there at this time. Instead, I want to cover the events we can accept this, we can expect to see somewhere in the time frame that lies between 2015 today and the tribulation period, the near future. What's going to happen to Israel before the tribulation? So I call the class, "The Romans and Russians Are Coming, Oh My." The Romans and Russians are coming, oh my. Now, this class does exist on the HUD of our website, but in audio form only. And what I want to do is update this class to an audiovisual form. So the class will cover, first of all, the Romans part of the class will cover Daniel chapter 2, verses 32 through 45, and chapter 7, verses 23 through 27. That's the Romans are coming section. And the Russians are coming section will cover Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. So that gives you a good hint as to where this class is going to go. The Romans and Russians are coming, oh my. So that's where we're going as we seek to understand what the modern state of Israel will encounter in the years that we may witness. We may witness these events as they come about. Now, when this class is posted on the website, "The Romans and Russians Are Coming" will be viewed and posted as an independent class on the HUD of our website. In order to find the class, go to the HUD of our website. This is our homepage. And go to the menu at the top of the page, that's part of the menu that says School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. So click on that, and a menu will drop down. You'll have a drop-down menu. Go down to the drop-down part of the menu that says Online Classes. Click on Online Classes. Now that will take you to the online class page. And so drop down there to the online class archive. When the class is going on, it'll appear under current classes. but it will also appear under the online class archive. And then just start scrolling down the online class archive until you find it. You'll have to go quite a ways down the archive, but eventually you'll come down in the under the T's to the Romans and Russians are coming, oh my. We'll be updating that particular class for you as an extension of the First Regathering Modern Israel. All right, so that brings us up to date as to where we are. We've actually finished the First Regathering Modern Israel, except for this additional extension. So we'll see you next week for the Romans and Russians are coming, oh my. And you have a good time as you wait for that class to begin. So shalom harav arex, and God bless.